At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com. Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. Ryan Brode is a seasoned writer whose essays have graced the pages of numerous prestigious publications. Recently, he achieved another milestone with the publication of his first book, Tributaries. Ryan's connection to the outdoors runs deep. Growing up surrounded by the hunting and fishing culture of the Belgrade Lakes region, he learned about fishing from his father, a generational guide. This upbringing shaped his path, leading him to become a Maine guide in his early 20s. Today, Ryan shares his passion for both storytelling and the natural world as a teacher of first-year writing and creative nonfiction at the University of New England. In this episode of Anchored, we discuss fishing in Maine, how to fly fish from a canoe comfortably, fishing for carp in tidal waters, what makes us angler hunters, choosing passion over profit in this day and age, and so much more. So, I met you through Miles.
Yes.
Speaking of Miles, I just pressed record now for people who are hopping on. And I was talking about how this microphone, if you're watching on YouTube, this mic's been around for a long time, since the beginning of this show. I didn't film episode one because that was with Lonnie Waller and it was footage that we stole from my old TV show. But since episode two, this has been the mic. And I was just saying to Ryan that when I was podcasting Miles, I was breastfeeding Adelaide and trying to hide her face or hide my boob, I guess, behind this microphone. So here we are.
That's like the definition of multitasking.
I am sitting here fully dressed today. So lucky you. But let's talk about how we met. So when I worked at Meat Eater, Miles was my editor. And and he was the one who suggested you. And I believe he said that you were one of the most talented writers that he knew and had a particularly interesting background because you are a generational guide.
Yes. Well, that's flattering, first of all. And Miles, I've worked with a fair number of editors, including your friend Sam, who's a great editor. But Miles actually shows you his edits. You know, and I sent him a piece that's in my book that I felt pretty good about, and it was pretty clean, and I'd revised it about 30 times, and his edits were incredible. And a lot of times editors will accept a piece, and then you're kind of hoping it gets in the magazine, the next issue, and you see it, and they don't really show you the edits that they do. You don't really learn anything from that process, but I still have the Word document that he sent me with his edits, because it was like a masterclass in line edits, so... Yeah, no, I'm grateful that I got a chance to work with Miles.
I think he's the only editor I haven't argued with. I mean, I don't actually argue, but I haven't debated changes with. He's on point. So,
agreed. Yeah, he is. Yeah, right. Which gives you a lot. It gives me a lot of confidence when I send him a piece. But yeah, no, my father grew up just outside New York City, and he moved to Maine in the late 70s. And he said that the two things he was looking for, he wanted to be able to take a leak off his front porch, and he wanted to be able to hunt without getting in his truck. And that was like the two requirements for his new residence. So, and then he got his guide, his master Maine guide's license in the late 70s, and he did the striper stuff here in the Kennebec River back when it was really good, before it kind of crashed. It crashed, I think, in like the 90s, the middle to later 90s. So I have all these photographs of him with his clients, you know, with these 40-pound striped bass caught in the middle of the day. And I missed it. I got here too late for that. So, yeah, but that was, you know, we lived an hour and a half north of the striper fishery, but he would go down there at 4 in the morning and come back late at night. And that was my first exposure to the possibility of guiding.
Yeah, and I'm going to pepper you with questions now. And this is going to be a slightly different format because usually I start with where you were born and raised, but I'm really interested in a little bit of the history before you were born, and then obviously we'll dive into your background. So, is it Broad or Broad?
It's Broad, yeah, Broad.
Broad. Okay. So,
Yeah.
was your dad a well-known guide? How did that all happen? Because he would have been quite early, right? Or was Maine already established as a guiding territory in the 70s?
I think he may have started in the early 80s with the striper stuff. And I think there are a handful of guides on the southern, like on the lower Kennebec River, doing day trips mostly. And I don't think many people have fished at night at that point. You know, it was still, there was so, the population of, the migratory stripers were so strong that you could have a sustainable fishery with a handful of guides with just daytime fishing. A lot of it was like plug fishing and bait fishing. He didn't do a lot of fly stuff. And there were bluefish too. He was just telling me about like acres of bunker down by the mouth of the Kennebec, and how his clients would complain about the 15-pound bluefish because they were tired, their arms were tired, and they were like, well, when are we gonna, you know, he would like go out on the near the ocean at slack tide and catch these 15-pound bluefish. And I don't know if there's been a 15-pound bluefish in that area in a really long time. So yeah, I think there were a handful of guys doing what he was doing. He was doing it part-time. He was never a full-time guide. And I think it was two things. I think he tired of just the bullshit with some of his clients. And I think he, once I kind of got of age where I became obsessed with fishing, which is around age 9 or 10, I think he didn't want to be away very much. And we fished together a lot.
But he was able to support you growing up. And again, this is where we'll start to kind of bring you into the picture here. So you were born to parents who at the time were together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, my mom was a high school teacher, and my dad was a clinical social worker. So he's like a counselor on the side. And then he did the guiding kind of on the side and in the summer times seasonally. Yeah.
Gotcha. That makes sense. And then
Yep.
growing up, and I'm asking selfishly now, how did he keep you interested in fishing? Because my daughter is over it now. She wants to row, she wants to do archery, but if I love fishing, she no longer wants to do fishing. If I love hunting, she doesn't want to go hunting. It's almost, she's six and she's rebelling. Help me.
I bet it's just a phase. I bet you when she's like 12 or 13 or 14, she'll like come back around. That's my guess. I'm just like, I want to put that out there.
Did you go through a phase? Do you remember your first fishing memory and how it all unfolded?
His parents, so my dad's parents bought a camp on the Serpentine River in central Maine, which is like it's like a bog. But I feel like as a kid, your first experience fishing has a kind of a mystical quality to it. So if anyone, you know, went to this place now, you'd look at it and think it's full of milfoil and duckweed. It's not the prettiest water, but yeah, my grandparents were there from May through September, and I would stand on their dock, and my grandmother, who's this like 4'10" Polish woman, would like call at me to come in for dinner, and I would refuse to come in because I, you know, I'd like chuck my bobber out there as far as I possibly could and just be fixated on it for hours. And she had this little bell that she would ring to try to get my attention, and I would just ignore it as long as I possibly could.
That sounds about right. I think my husband's still the same.
Right. I never went through a phase of like, you know, I'm going to take a step back from fishing. It's actually been like an acceleration from that point. And then when I was like 10 or 12, my dad introduced me to fly fishing, and he had never had formal training. He never like worked with a casting instructor. His father was not someone who he spent a lot of time with growing up. So he had taught himself to fly cast. And if you see him fly cast, even now, you would think, okay, it's not pretty, but he's like very effective. You know, he even at almost 80 years old, like he'll get the fly where it needs to be. And when I realized that was a possibility at this time in the Kennebec, these 3 to 5 pound brown trout would eat these tiny little flies in the evening. That was it. That was all.
So yeah. did you also want to be a guide? Where was your head at as far as looking toward your future?
Oh, that's a really good question. I wanted to be a basketball player first, and that didn't
Are you tall? You look tall.
Yeah, I'm like I'm 6'5" or so. Gotcha. Yeah, which is weird because my dad's like 5'8" and my mom's 5'7" and my grandmother's 4'10". So I'm not sure what happened, but I've kind of bounced around. I mean, I think I never leaned towards guiding as a full-time thing. I've always been interested in storytelling and writing. And teaching, I think, too, was always in the back of my mind to some extent. I honestly didn't really know what I wanted to do when I was a teenager. But I think I saw that my dad used it as sort of a supplemental way to make some money, but also to just to stay in the game, you know, and to he had relationships with some of his clients that really mattered to him. So it was never like, I want to quit everything and become a fishing guide. It was, I love fishing so much and I love the shared experience, particularly with people who are developing and you haven't had as much opportunity as me. I love being in the back of the skiff. I love being in the back of the canoe. I love watching someone line something up for the first time and like see how they their recognition of what's possible for them. And I'm at the point now where I've fished so much that 99% of the time when I'm fishing for friends, like not fishing with friends, not guiding, I'm in the back or I'm pulling my skiff. Like I'm not, we're not casting at the same time, like seeing who, you know, catches more fish. I like watching the setup and my dad and I fished exclusively from a canoe and he would always be in back and he would always like position me for the cast. He'd always be the net man. And we've kind of like switched roles at this point. And he's very stubborn about it, but I kind of insist that he goes in front of the canoe now. So I can paddle him around a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Is that a real East Coast thing? Yeah. I've never fished in Maine, but have fished New Brunswick and have fished a little bit back east in other areas in Canada. Is Maine very similar to that sort of culture and history? Do you know anything about the history over there when it comes to not stripers? We'll get into stripers in a minute, but maybe to some of the salmon and trout.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's a tradition with Maine guides to have like these old town canoes. A lot of Maine guides had these larger canoes that they could put like a small outboard on and do like trolling during the day and fly casting at night. But I think it is part of the cultural identity, especially on the northern rivers. There were guides that would pull, like have these long sticks and actually pull down these shallower parts of rivers. And I think accessibility wise, and it is interesting that you mentioned that culturally drift boats are less common here. We have some for sure, but you'll see more canoes on the rivers and more people wading on the rivers. So yeah, I think it's more of like the Maine identity kind of thing and the history of the Maine guide, and that you see these old photographs of people up at Upper Dam on the near Moose Lake McGuntick in these canoes anchored up with their early, you know, very early days of guiding. So I think I think the canoe itself is part of the main tradition with Maine, early Maine guides, and it's just sort of stuck around.
Are salmon, Atlantic salmon specifically, still a major part of the fishery in Maine?
They are endangered, and you're not allowed to fish for them recreationally. So there's a big push in Maine with dam removals, as there is obviously everywhere. But the Atlantic salmon numbers have been pretty miserable for a long time. And that fishery, you know, up on the Penobscot in particular, I think the last recreational fishing was in the 80s, early 80s, before they closed it. So it's been a really long time.
I didn't know that.
So there is no recreational fishing for Atlantic. There's landlocked salmon, which they're are plentiful and they're great fun on a fly rod. But yeah, the Atlantic salmon, that's another thing I wish I had been around for. Yeah, it's a little bit sad, but there's efforts in place now to sort of reseed the rivers and see if fish will come back, and trying to get dams removed. But yeah, I mean, people are optimistic, but I don't think the numbers have significantly increased.
I'm going to look real stupid here, but I don't care. So that's like okay. Topher Brown, I always thought he was fishing in Maine. Where is the Sault Ste. Marie? Where is that?
Sault Ste. Marie, I think, is like Upper Peninsula, Michigan.
Oh, so that's not the one I'm thinking of. There's a fishery somewhere in the Maine region or in a bordering state that has got Atlantic salmon that they were still fishing for 15 years ago. Where is that?
Yeah, it's in Canada. The Miramichi, is that what it is?
Oh, that would be New Brunswick. I mean, yes, it's short answer is yes. But I thought there was one in America.
Very possible. I'm not sure.
I'll have to have a look into it. Let's talk about stripers. Was there controversy from a conservation stance? And I know we're going in deep here. This is, again, not usually my format. But was there controversy with the stripers and the salmon like we've had in Canada, in Eastern Canada?
Oh, interesting. I think because both populations have been returning to Maine forever, that hasn't been an issue. I know the return of like mature stripers in Maine is way, way down. There's still a pretty good fishery in southern Maine, like Saco Bay area, and even up to the Kennebec at sometimes. But they've been coexisting for so long that I don't think that's as much like you said up in the Miramichi and other parts in Canada for a bunch of different reasons, right? A bunch of different shifts. The striped bass are kind of infiltrating areas that were historically just Atlantic salmon. But that's not so much the case in Maine because they've both been returning here for thousands of years.
Okay. And yeah. I know nothing about stripers. I've never caught one. So I'm going to have questions for you later. We'll come back to those.
Yeah. Coming back to you. Just completely transparent. Stripers hate me. I have a very interesting relationship with striped bass. I'm happy to answer as much as I can, but I may not be the striped bass guy. My friends would reiterate that.
What are you? What did you guide for?
Yeah, no, for sure. I guide for pike, northern pike, and muskie, and salmon and trout, bass. I've also Maine has a tidal carp population. Uh huh. And they're like 10 to 15 pounds. They tail, they mud like bonefish. And very few people fish for them. So I've become obsessed with carp. All my friends
saw that fishing. In your book. Yeah. You had a dig and it was you had mentioned the carp alongside another species. I can't remember what it was, but you had sort of a dig about it being the best that there is. And I couldn't tell if you meant the carp or the other fish. Were you referring to the carp?
I'm referring to the carp. Yeah. 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 Okay. Yeah. I mean, I've been fishing for them for like 6 summers as hard as I can. I think I've caught like maybe 13 or 14, something like that. I think they're incredibly difficult. And I'm fishing in like a technical pulling skiff. They're in 2 feet of water and they act like permit. They do not respond, honestly to a fly and, it's sight fishing and they're like big backcountry redfish that don't eat flies and I'm kind of obsessed with them. Yeah.
Okay. So let's get back to you in high school. Did you know early on that you wanted to be a writer?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I've always been interested in storytelling. I wrote like really bad poems in elementary school. The school librarian, whose name I can't think of, hope she forgives me. She told me at the end of sixth grade, when I was graduating, she gave me like a book of Robert Frost poems and said, like, I think you're going to be a writer. And I was like, okay, yeah, that's nice. That's great. I think I've always been drawn to stories and, you know, I've been doing a lot of readings around Maine, talking about my book, reading from my book, and people are asking, like, what pulls you to this? Like, why do you write about these experiences? You know, and the best explanation I have is that I feel like on some level, whether it's conscious or not, I feel like I'm trying to build a kind of a catalog of memories, particularly with my father and other people that I know won't be around forever. So that, there are like these images and these moments that you have on every fishing trip that you return to, right? And they stay with you. And I guess I could say I'm someone who does tend to like revisit those things, like those moments that like the first time I caught a tarp, and the moments that your mind can't quite grasp in the moment, when I'm able to write about those things, I feel like it's a kind of catalog that I can return to and people I care about can return to. People who have had similar experiences will read it and hopefully have a kind of parallel memory. They're like reading my story, but also having the experience of thinking about a particular moment in their path, you know? So I think it's also like a way for me to go fishing again, right? It's a way for me to go hunting again, because good writing is being like hyper present in that memory in that moment, and like taking these images from my life and like putting them in the reader's brain and saying like, here, I want you to look at this. And, you know, just like, I think angling is very intentional. Our choices are very intentional. That's, there's a parallel there with writing. Yeah, it's a long answer.
No, it's good. And I will say, because look, I obviously podcast a lot of authors, and so it would be very difficult for me to try to get through everyone's book, but I'm really annoyed at myself that I started yours so late, because I'm genuinely invested. I'm fully invested. I need to get a paper copy, because the computer is great, but I like want to sit down with a cup of coffee in the morning and read. You are a fantastic writer. So let's lead up to this, because obviously I want to share all the details of your book, but I still need to get back to young Ryan wrote here. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So you graduate. What's the plan when you graduate high school?
The plan is to go play college basketball at this small, dinky D3 school. I really wanted to do journalism. I was interested in sports journalism at that time. I've always been, baseball was my first love. Fishing was my second love. The baseball narrative crashed quite early when I screwed up my pitching arm. So after high school, it was like, okay, I'm going to continue this path. I got really tall. Like I was good at basketball. I'm not like D1 good, but I was like D3 good. you know, and then it's hard to look back at choices we make in college and think, here I was at like 18 making this decision that would have tremendous impact on the rest of my life. And I wish I could go back to 18-year-old Ryan and be like, Ryan, why did you go to school in like Maryland? Why don't you go, you should have gone to like Montana or Idaho or, you know, or something like that. So I went to school for basketball.
Why would you have gone? Yeah.
Well, I think I was kind of fixated on the basketball piece. And I thought that if that went well, it would cover up the reality of like not being able to do these outdoor things that like make me feel like myself. Right. I was like right outside Baltimore. I was like probably a little depressed as well at that time. And I think in part because I was in this new environment, the basketball thing didn't work out. I really hated it. I hated the way it took over my life. I don't think I fished my whole freshman year of college, which was difficult. And I met some lovely people I'm still friends with, but I didn't find my people, if that makes sense. Right. Yeah. Like I did not find them there. So it's been kind of, I transferred, I went to UMA in Orono, which was like a little bit better. I did social work, which is what my dad and sister have done. I worked in the mental health field for 10 years after college, which was rewarding and also extremely stressful. And at that point, I decided that I wanted to go back to grad school for writing. And I did that, really chasing the money, you know, social work and writing.
Baller.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm thinking about retiring soon. No. but, you know, I got back to the writing. My, you know, elementary school librarian was right. Yeah. And I think when I went to graduate school for writing, it was the best 2 years of school of my life. My first semester mentor was Rick Bass, who's a well-known writer from Montana. And it was incredibly intimidating to work with him and totally kicked my ass. But helped me mold a few of the stories that are in the book and helped just kind of give me the confidence that this is something that I can do. And from there, I got into teaching, and I teach writing now. And that's, I'm absolutely in love with my job. My students are amazing. And honestly, I've been thinking about this because I'm an adjunct, and like I'm poor, and Miles can attest to that, like what that's like as an adjunct, like the grind of not having what you need, but loving the work. I was thinking if I had like full-time teaching and I guided in the summers and I would continue to publish, like those three things, I'm good. Like I'd be a very happy person for the rest of my life.
But is that what you have now?
I teach, but I don't, if I have like full-time, I'm an adjunct. So like, I don't make much money. I don't have like full-time benefits, even though I'm like basically doing the same work that faculty do. Yeah, exactly. So it's more about the financial part than it is the actually what I'm doing now. But yeah, that's sort of like, that's the goal. That's the aim, is that kind of triangle of publishing, guiding, and teaching.
I feel, again, like an idiot because I have no idea what an adjunct is. So what is that? Is that short for something?
It's short for exploitation. So an adjunct is like a contracted professor. They basically are like, okay, we need someone to teach these few classes. We're going to pay you like an incredibly low amount of money. You're not going to get, this is not about tenure. This is not like a track for you to get full-time work here. It's not a guarantee of anything other than these two or three classes on the contract. You don't get benefits. You're not part of the faculty. In fact, you're kind of invisible to the faculty. So it's sort of like, it's cheap labor for universities.
So it's a subcontractor at a really low rate.
That's correct. And I think a lot of, and this is happening all over the country, the adjunct is kind of a cliche. They come in and they kind of parachute in and they teach and then they leave and they're very much invisible to their faculty. I'm not there because I have strong connections with faculty. I'm there because of the students and they're incredible. Essentially it's like a job in which you can go and work really hard and no one's watching. I actually had a conversation with my boss about this today, in which I was not quite happy, but I'm not complaining about the work. Like I love the work. I get to talk about writing all day. I get to read these students' essays. I get to hear them read aloud in front of a crowd of people that they've never done before. And there is, I think part of this process with the book too, is we've had a chance to reflect on it. Cause you're so close to it for so long, you can't really see it. And then after a while you can, is like these obsessions, like these like patterns of returning to places every season for particular things, this experience of like teaching for no money because I love it. There are like consequences of that, right? The consequences that are, I don't have like savings. I save up all of my extra money to go tarpon fishing 2 days a year. I have to like buy my own health insurance. I don't own a home, you know, and I'm in my late 30s. And I was thinking about that the other day, like, would I change that? I'd like to have like more stability, but it's a kind of lifestyle. And I think the book is the product of that, right? And I'm not going to get rich or famous from this book, but it's me, you know, and there has to be like a level of acceptance that these are the things that you love to do. These are the people you choose to spend your time with. And as I've gotten older, I've gotten far more selective about who I spend time with, right? Like, I think when you're a kid and you're fishing, you think, oh my God, I have all this time. This is incredible. I have all these years to look forward to, right? And then you get into your 20s and things speed up and you get into your 30s and all your friends are getting married and having kids. And you realize, oh yeah, this is very limited. This is very fleeting. Like, what am I going to do at this time? You know, and this is what I want to do.
Yeah. How did all this start? What came first, the guiding or the teaching?
I was guiding in my early 20s, part-time. I was doing a lot of like smallmouth bass fly fishing trips, a lot of trout trips, some pike trips. I do a lot of pike fly fishing in this shallow water, which I love. And all the work, the guiding and the mental health crisis work that I was doing and teaching, it's like the thing that I didn't have in college was connection. It was like genuine connection with people that I wanted to spend time with, right? And it sounds like very simple, but I feel like moving towards connection, that's sort of what the relationships in the book are about. The connection you have with a client, having like a great day together, even if the fishing isn't great, a connection I have with a client that I'm assessing who's having a mental health crisis, the connection I have with my student who writes this like amazing, beautiful, vulnerable essay and reads it in front of class and everyone's like tearing up, including myself. Like, I love that stuff. I love like those moments where you feel like you're having a genuine connection with people. I don't like in our world that doesn't seem to happen very often organically. And those are like three venues where I feel like I'm able to have that connection with people.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high-quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
I mentioned earlier that I met you through Miles and I didn't give any context. And I was writing an article about guiding and I was writing a 5-part series on whether becoming a fishing guide was a decision that that someone might want to make. And when I had finished writing the series, I turned it into a podcast. You can find the podcast on Anchor. And I think it's called So You Want to Be a Fishing Guide. And then also put it on YouTube. And I can hear your voice now. And I think I can remember what, because I had you send me an audio snippet, right?
Yeah.
Of you reading your part. And I think I remember, now that I can put a face to it, now that we're sitting here and we've got a little bit of moment or time, bit of time to get to know each other. I'm going to be kind of brazen here and ask you something, even though admittedly I have not listened to the audio clip in a while, but something's just resonating. I thought I remembered hearing a little bit, it wasn't sadness, but there was something off in that it was, I don't know if it was almost like a defiance, but your tone was slightly different than the rest.
Interesting.
And I'm wondering if there's anything more to it, you know, with your, I think I recall your snippet was something about how, yeah, life is too short to be spending time with people that you don't like. And I'm just wondering if you're feeling a little bit of pushback. I feel like there's a bit of pushback in you now. I mean, I hope that you go in, you know, all blazing, talking to your boss or whomever, manager, whatever they're called, to go to full time. But is there a little bit of defiance that's finally starting to kettle up? Like, are you reaching a breaking point?
Yes, I am. And that was my conversation with my boss earlier, is feeling like the conflict is we find these things that we love to do, and then we realize that those things may not sustain us in the world that we're in certain ways, right? Like, it may not provide stability or the adult things that we're supposed to have. I mean, I think the clip about who we spend our time with is like thinking about the plethora of guiding experiences I've had, from like absolutely wonderful to a drunk guy stepping in my canoe and flipping us over in the middle of the river, you know, just like a wide range of experiences. And every time I take someone to one of these places that I'm obsessed with, that I love, that I return to in different seasons, it's kind of a vulnerable thing, because you're paying me to go to this place that I'm familiar with, that I know intimately, and I'm showing it to you. And I'm like, I'm bringing you into that place. And I don't want to do that with someone who, just because they're paying me, just because they're like, oh yeah, you're like, you're the guy that, you're the carp guy, you're the smallmouth guy, you're the pike guy, I see. And I think that mentality also comes from, you know, a lot of the book is my obsession with tarpon fishing and the recognition that tarpon fishing in the Keys is a very exclusive sport, right? And, a lot of the people that go down there and hire guides for 30 or 40 or 60 days a year, they make a lot of money and they have expendable income, and that's wonderful for them. But I also know from knowing guides down there that they've had to chisel out a business in a place where there are tons of guides dealing with people who have really high expectations, a lot of money, right? A lot of power in their jobs. And they've had to sort of like take them back down to earth and say, actually, you have a tailing loop and your casting sucks, right? And here's this person who's making $2 million a year who like doesn't want to hear from the guide about how bad the casting is, right? So I think that for them, it's like the process of whittling down who are the clients that I want to work with who are able to do this. And my guide who I write about in the book has like, he lets me stay with him when I come down there because he knows I'm kind of broke. I pay him. Honestly, I don't really know what he charges because like the last couple of years, he just like doesn't tell me. I just pay him as much as I can. We're cool with that. He's cool with that. And I like send him flies and maple syrup and like try to like make up for the fact that I can't like tip him an Audi or something.
are you sure you're not Canadian?
No, I mean, I'm close. I'm not. Yeah. I mean, a couple hundred miles south. So yeah, I mean, there's no amount of money that you can pay me to spend time with someone that I don't want to show these places that are so important to me. And I have clients that I still see that I love being around. And that's, I would rather be broke than like spend a canoe is a very small space for 8 hours with someone you don't want to be with, you know? The same thing with a skiff, right? And everything changes when you develop a relationship and you see someone year after year. And it's about the fishing, but it's also like you have a day to catch up and to ask them about their kids and tell them about the book, you know, and just like talk as humans who are like unplugged from their jobs for 6 hours, like sharing this goal of trying to hook a giant pike in shallow water on a fly.
Is there a species that helps to kind of, what's the word to kind of mend any issues, or is there a species that kind of fills the void, something that brings everyone together? It doesn't matter if they're a dickhead or if they're a newbie or if they're wonderful, just something that is kind of a one fits all species that works for you.
Yeah. I mean, I think Maine has some of the best smallmouth bass fishing. And the smallmouth bass is like, it's not a particularly sexy fish, but they're incredibly forgiving. It's a great fish for beginning and intermediate anglers because they eat the shit out of flies. They will let you screw up and probably eat the fly again on the same cast. They fight great. They jump. They'll eat top water. They'll eat stuff off the bottom. They'll eat everything. And they're big, you know, and if they grew to 50 pounds, I probably wouldn't fish for anything else, right? I mean, they're incredible fish. So that is one fish. There's something like gritty about, and I like that about smallmouth. Like they live in places where the other fish couldn't live, and there's like a kind of toughness about them that I respect in a way. And I've had anglers who are like blue ribbon trout guys who are like, yeah, you know, I guess I've heard smallmouth fishing is really good. I mean, let's give it a shot. And they're like, well, okay, yeah, this is interesting, you know, this is interesting. Like this thing's like pulling into my backing on a 7-weight in this river with really strong current. And I've also, there's something, I think bass in general, it's oftentimes the fish that people start with. So you see that come full circle when I guide this guy several years ago, who was probably in his late 70s, early 80s, and comes from the family of anglers. And he wanted to bass fish, and he's been all over the world. He's done permafishing and tarpon fishing, et cetera, et cetera. And I could just see him kind of like getting into this level of comfort bass fishing, the smallmouth fishing, and how much he loved it, which is like, you can find smallmouth, I think, pretty much everywhere, right? You don't have to go to the far ends of the earth. They're kind of like a blue collar fish, you know, and they, I love those things. They definitely bring people together in the sense of there's like a respect, I think, among anglers and these fish. Yeah. And they've saved so many days for me. Oh my God. I love those things.
How do you guide out of a canoe? I've recently started fishing out of a canoe and I find it terribly unenjoyable. And I want to know what I'm doing wrong.
You're really selling my business, April. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry. How do you do it? How do you cast? Do you have swivel chairs? What do I need to do to make my experience better?
Yeah, you need to get a guide who has a drift boat. Well, I mean, part of it's maneuverability, and I can get in really shallow water, and I can like pretty much stop the vessel in place. Yeah, I think the tricky thing, right, is if you're sitting kind of low to the water, stripping is hard, right? Because you can strip and you're like stripping right into the seat of the canoe. So I'll have some clients will like kneel. I'll put like a throw pad on the bottom of the canoe, and they'll kind of kneel, and they'll have a little bit of space to throw the loose line between their legs, between their knees, and they can cast, and they have a little more distance to strip.
I also
fish people who stand up, and that there's a photo of that in the book. My friend Parker, who's in the book quite a lot, he and I have kind of perfected that, and we're not sight fishing, but there's one angler in front and he's standing, and he's like 5'6" and I'm 6'5", so I'm better in the back of the canoe in that situation or else. But it's the same thing that my dad did. One person in back lining up the shots, positioning the canoe, another person. I've had some clients who I feel comfortable standing in the canoe going through a rapidly moving river, and other people I do not want them to stand up, you know. But there are ways, you know. Sometimes I'll drop anchor in certain pools, and that helps people feel more comfortable. I think the toughest thing is when you're on a skiff, you have more ability to use your lower body, you know, to cast and to kind of brace yourself and to create more kind of line speed. And when you're sitting in a canoe, it's entirely upper body, right? So it actually forces you to slow down, because if you don't, then you're going to be slapping the water on both sides. So in a way, like, that's how I grew up fly fishing, was sitting in the front of a canoe, right? Being very aware of the canoe's movements and angles and positioning. And when I guide, it's the same thing. You have to work with different clients to figure out what works for them, because there's no resolution to the fact that like canoes are not super comfortable after like 3 hours, right? So part of my day is like, I need to figure out places where I can stop and get out. People can walk around, stretch, take some shots waiting, get back in, try something totally different. But you also, like, I think in a canoe, you feel very much like you're in the river. In a drift boat, it's more comfortable for sure. You're a little more elevated, you can stand. But there's something about a canoe that feels more intimate to me. I just feel more connected to the environment that I'm in. And it's really versatile, I think. It's a great way to fish dry flies as well. Yeah. But again, yeah, it's not, maybe not the best situation for like a 6 hour drift with a 70-year-old, but I've made it work.
Yeah. What about carp? Do you fish for carp out of a canoe?
No. So I have my dad and I went in on a skiff. It's like a 16-foot shallow water skiff that I fish out of for carp in Merrymeeting Bay. It's the only place where we have carp in Maine. They were put there in the late 1800s by European settlers as like a food source. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why. I mean, maybe because they're so durable, they could bring them over and they knew they'd survive. But it sounds to me, I've not done a lot of permit fishing, but successful carp fishing for me has come mostly from wading. So I've caught some fish from the skiff, but a lot of times it's there are particular flats where they'll tail and they'll mud. And God, they're so spooky. They act like fish that are pressured every day. And in the 5 or 6 years of fishing for them, I've seen one other person fishing. So they're not being pressured for the most part. But something about stealth, and I think I'm screwing up. There's something I'm doing with polling, with the skiff. There's something that's tipping them off. And I don't know what it is yet. It's my own stupidity, but there's something, if I can get out or have my client or friend get out, just the success rate is way higher. I think it has to do with noise level, with just the level of stealth too. And some of the flats are kind of gnarly to walk through. They're pretty muddy and pretty stuff. I've lost some tennis shoes. And we call one of the flats tennis shoe flat, because I literally, the suction pulled 2 tennis shoes off my feet. They're still there, I'm sure. I don't feel good about that, but yeah, I think a canoe would be too difficult And it, with the skiff, I'm, you know, being 6'5" and then being up on a polling platform on a good vis day, I can see them a long ways away and set people up. Yeah.
And are they usually in groups of 2, 5 solo?
Yeah. It really depends. I've seen a mix. You don't see them in giant groups. It's usually 3 or 4 or less. And a lot of times when they're feeding, it's a single or a pair. And, yeah, I mean, I've seen fish that were well over 20 pounds. I haven't caught those ones yet, but I've caught fish over 14 pounds. And, yeah, I mean, they blend in pretty well. And in the high tide in Maine and Marion Bay, they go up in the, there's like these wild rice things, and they'll go and kind of float in those grasses. You'll just see them kind of floating in there, like laid out to the ground. Yeah.
What do you mean? What do you mean high tide? Is this tidal influenced?
Yeah, it's tidal. Yeah, it's Marion Bay. So the only carp fishery that Maine has is tidal. So, and they're not. It's kind of brackish water. It's not full salt water. I don't think carp can survive salt. Although I'm not entirely sure about that. So it's like mostly fresh water. But yeah, it's tidal. So I think most people, they think of carp, they think of like a little pond behind a Walmart or something, and that's cool. And they're in rivers, right? And that kind of thing. And lakes, obviously, in the Great Lakes, there's some giant ones. Yeah, but these are tidal, and the feeding windows are really narrow. So like last 45 minutes of the outgoing tide is when they like really push and mud and tail. So it creates that sort of saltwater flats environment, you know, and you have the pressure of the ticking clock because, you know, at low tide, you're kind of done. Yeah.
What are they feeding on? Is it still nymphs, or could you throw a little shrimp and stuff in there at them?
There's a bunch of worms, like these little tiny red worms. I'm giving away all my secrets. Tiny little red worms. They eat mollusks too. I have not caught them on nymphs. The only thing I've caught them on is like a heavy weighted fly. And, you know, you see these videos of guys that like throw, guys and gals, they'll throw way past the fish and like drag it over their head and then drop it. I haven't had a ton of success with that. But mostly I'm just throwing so they can see the fly kind of falling. And if they see it falling without it plunking them on the head, they tend to respond pretty well. If you throw at one that's like floating in the grass, they will not eat it. If someone knows that, please let me know. You want the ones that are like bulldozing, their head is in the mud. You know, on the outgoing tide, you'll see you'll see the mud that's like 30 yards long because the tide is pulling the mud out. And it's, they can't really hide when they're doing that. But yeah, they're incredibly spooky fish. I wish the feeding window was a little longer because it gets a little stressful because, you know, you have an hour basically to get it done.
Yeah.
Each day. Yeah. You know, so it's like, yeah.
But you mentioned earlier, stripers in the dark, which is actually something I did not know that was a thing. Are there other species that have the same, that you also fish for in the dark? Do you fish for carp in the dark? Can you?
I don't know about carp. I mean, I tarpon fish a lot in the dark.
Yes.
For sure. A lot. Yeah. And that's like when all the guides are not there. I mean, striper is brown trout. I know that there are some guys who fish brook trout a particular way at night. I've never done that before. I've tried mousing for browns at night, and I've had some success with that. I know some guys who have tried that with rainbows with less success. I've tried ice fishing for pike at night. No luck. I know a few people who've caught pike at like 9:30 at night. And a few people who've caught muskie, from a boat at night. But I've not had any success doing that. So I don't know. I mean, carp, their eyesight sucks. They smell and they kind of like feel around with those little, the barbule things on their chin. So I don't, it's a good question. I don't know. That would open things up a little bit.
I wonder what they do at night. I wonder if anyone snorkels with carp. You know, we snorkel with trout and salmon and steelhead. Do they do it with carp?
They should, if they don't. Yeah. But you tend to live in like kind of murky stuff. So I bet the vis is not great. Hard to see. Yeah. You gotta be really up close to them to see them. But yeah, I love those things. And I know they're invasive. They've been here since 18 something, but, they haven't moved anywhere. That's like, they have not been, you know, dropped anywhere else by people, which is good. And some people, I think some locals on the rivers where they are in Merrymeaning Bay kind of upset because when they're feeding, there's a lot of silt and the river gets kind of cloudy at times. And I hear that. And also, I love them.
Okay. So how long have you been? You're almost 40 now, I think I read.
Yeah.
30.
Yeah. I'm 39 until the 30th of this month. So yeah, I'm barely hanging on to my 30s.
I think you're going to really enjoy your 40s personally.
Okay. What should I do? First of all, what should I look forward to? Do you think?
Well, I'm new. I'm only 41.
Okay. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. And it's my favorite era so far.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think it's because I finally have realized what is the most important thing to me, and that's time.
Yeah.
B, I thought that I was suddenly going to become fat and awful at 40. And so I put in a lot of work to be fit. I'm fitter now. I am more fit now than I have ever been, including in my 20s. I feel like I'm a little more respected maybe because I'm a little bit older. But mostly I'm just very validated in my decisions to decide that I don't have time for X, Y, Z, and I do have time for A, B, C. And when I make the decision to do or not do something, I trust myself because I've got, you know, experience. And I don't know, like, I'm sure the 50s are great too, but the 40s, yeah. I thought we're going to be just this scary, horrible old thing. And it's great. What a time to be alive.
That's so good to hear. Thank you. I needed to hear that. I will bet you,
we can even put a dollar on this if you'd like. I will bet you that you
I can afford that bet.
Especially seeing you percolate and just watching you, and I don't know you, but I like to think that I can just read people a little bit.
Yeah.
I bet you wrote that book partly. I bet you a bit of that has made you feel like you've taken control of your life. And I bet you go into 40 now, not afraid to speak your mind. You do it very well. And I think that you're going to grab life by the balls and you won't be an adjunct for much longer. That's my personal opinion. That's my little fortune teller vibe.
I appreciate that. And I will do everything I can to make that true.
So you've been guiding then for say close to 20 years soon enough, it'll be close to 20 years. How many days a week do you guide and how much longer do you think you will be guiding for?
That's a good question. I mean, there have been some years where I haven't guided at all and some years where I'll guide a couple times a month in the summer. I mean, I have like 4 or 5 trips in the spring, mostly pike stuff, some smallmouth stuff. I'm working on getting my captain's license because technically the carp fishing, it's title, so you need a captain's license to guide there. So I'm in the process of that process there. I would like to continue guiding. I would like to get the captain's license and really develop the carp fishery. There's only a few guys doing it. I think one other guy really. It allows me to like explore things. It allows me to sort of like sharpen my craft too. I'm also like an obsessive fly tier and I tie for SS Flies, which is like a great fly tying company in Maine. And I love guiding too because it's like a testing facility for my flies. Right. And I love that process of developing something and having someone throw it and having it work. That's very satisfying too.
Yeah. What about this book? Talk to me a little bit about the title and where people can find it. Is it out for release yet?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So it came out in the fall. So it came out in late 2023. Mm-hmm. It's called Tributaries, Essays from Woods and Waters. And it's a collection of outdoor essays that I would say it's sort of focusing on male relationships, in particular my relationship with my father, my relationship with one of my best friends, Parker, who's like my fishing buddy, and my relationship with Rich Campiola, who's a terrific guide in the Keys, grew up in New England, but guides down there, who has gone from like, you know, that relationship is, I think, maybe the most interesting for me in this book because I've been on both sides of guiding and angling, and there's always a transactional component of guiding, right? And our friendship, I was just down there a couple of weeks ago fishing with him, has gotten so that the friendship side outweighs the transactional side. Like, of course, I'm going to pay him because he works his ass off and pulls all day in 20-knot winds like he just did for me 2 weeks ago. But I love that we can do that. And it's 2 days a year, you know? Those are my two favorite days of the year for fishing. And so I'd say the book is an exploration of those relationships, oftentimes about like men connecting or trying to connect, the things that we say and the things that we don't say. And also like exploring obsession and passion and that sort of fine line between the two, in the context of a lot of essays about Maine. There's some hunting essays, like a moose hunt that I went on, some deer hunting.
I'm in the middle of this moose hunt one right now, and I need to see what happens. I need to know don't tell me, but I need to know what happens.
Yeah. 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 My father is, he's an incredible hunter. I'm more of an angler. I think he would admit that too. Like, I love to hunt, but he's more of a hunter. But I think what I've recognized here in the book is that the type of fishing that I do is hunting. You know, it's not a numbers thing. It's like a very specific approach. And when you're carp fishing or tarpon fishing or musky fishing, it's hunting, and you're looking for one individual creature to interact with, right?
Uh-huh.
You jump a tarpon, your day is good. I'm good.
It took me years to figure out that I'm not a fisher. I'm a hunter. With my fishing, that's exactly the same. I'm exactly the same. I would rather spend all week just hunting one particular fish or sight fishing to that fish or trying to get closer, interact or just connect or communicate somehow with it rather than catch a bunch of trout.
100%. Yeah. Why is that? Like, why are certain people aligned that way? I don't actually know, but I'm the same way for sure. 100%. I don't know if it's like that singular focus, you know, I saw your Arapaima.
The Arapaima.
And I also saw that photo of the branches getting in your toe, which I'm still trying to get out of my head. I gravitate towards fishing that is like hunting, and that is very challenging. It's very difficult. I want to do the most difficult thing. It is not to be able to brag and say, hey, I caught a carp, or hey, I caught a permit. Mm-mm. It's because, you know, you just become so familiar with failure, right? And you keep kind of honing and sharpening. And when it lines up, it's terrific.
I have been thinking about this a little bit lately, wondering why I am like that. Because like I said, as I'm getting older, I generally find I have fewer people in my life as well. And I spend a lot more time outside, especially my daughter's in school now. So I spend a lot of time in the bush. I liken it to intimacy for me. Mm. And it's dark and very morbid, because sometimes whether it's hunting deer or a big fish, it's gruesome in a lot of ways, but it is intimacy. And I feel like, and I don't know if this is a testament to, you know, my own love and sex life, but like, I don't need a bunch of little guys. I just want that one, you know what I mean? And it's it's intimate. I cannot find, you mentioned, why are we like that? I don't know. Is it intimacy? I mean, I know you're sensitive. You said in yourself that you could be sensitive. I know a lot of guys who are kind of hunters who aren't overly sensitive. Could it also be intimacy? Why do you think, if we had to break it down psychologically, why would we be like that? And take ego out, because it's not, I'm not talking to the people who are in it for the ego, from the ego stance.
Yeah, I have no interest in that. You know, I have no interest in that conversation about those folks. Like, that's their prerogative, but like, I had zero interest in that. Boy, it's a really good question. I'm taking a second to think about it. I think it is intimacy. It's a kind of commitment as well. There's a commitment to this particular creature, right? If it's, let's say it's the moose hunt, right? It becomes, for me, it also becomes a relationship with the landscape in which you find that thing, right? And in the case of hunting, and I think fish that we want to fish for, they're so tremendously keyed into and sensitive to changes in their environment, right? So what I have to do when I'm tarpon fishing is I have to get this fly into their zone of awareness before they know it's there. and I need to move it in a way that it's moving away from them, and it's moving like the natural thing that it's imitating. And they get flies dumped on their fucking head at every turn in the keys, right? So I have to be the one that throws it and tricks this fish that's 60 years old and has seen 3,000 flies in its lifetime and sees some worm flies every day and is like, yeah, no way, man. Like, you got to be kidding. I'm not going to eat that, right? There is a level of intimacy with the creature, but there's also like this, you have to be, in a way, I have to kind of take myself out of the equation and sort of like, and think about how can I be in this environment in a way that doesn't tip off these creatures that are incredibly owned and have like their senses are so incredibly sharp to change, especially deer, like deer and moose. They're so attuned to changes in their environment, right? Like they, most of the time they know you're there. And in those rare times they don't know you're there, it feels like magic. It feels like a dream. Like how is that buck walking in? Okay, I'm downwind, but how does he not know I'm here? This feels incredible. And it's the same way when you finally make the right shot on a tarpon or a carp, and the carp tips up and eats it, or the tarpon gets the cross-eyed thing where they do before they eat your fly, where they get underneath your fly and you see them rise up and you're like, here it comes, you know? So for me, it's intimacy with the creature, but in maybe more so for me, it's this feeling that I develop with these places that I return to. And part of the book, and the epigraph from the book, which is from a Joy Harjo poem, is about return, about, you know, coming back to these places. And it's very intimate to go back to these places at different seasons, right? And to like recognize a particular tree or a particular boulder in a pool, right? Or a particular point where the tarpon will come around on a certain tide. That level of information, that level of like connection to place and recognition of the like the specificities of each location is incredibly intimate. And I don't think a lot of people, I shouldn't say that, cataloging that information in, like over the course of a lifetime feels like such a it's like a beautiful bit of work to do, right? Like how do I come back to this place as my life evolves and changes, and how do I remain open to the subtleties of it, like to the changes, even though I'm so familiar, right? How do I come back in a way that's fresh? How can I be successful? Or what's really hard for me is how can I return and fuck up and not be successful, right? And still be okay. Yeah.
I never thought about that, but you're right. The places too. Oh, now my brain, I'm going to be thinking about this after. Especially I've got a long solo day. It's hunting season. So I spent a lot of time out there just thinking, is it the animal? Because is it the intimacy with the animal? Because why do I get so relieved when I don't take a shot or I miss a shot or the fish looks at me and tells me to piss off? Is it the fact that it's behind the same tree every time? Is it because there's a rock in my front yard on the Bulkley that I have a relationship with this rock in that it directly impacts how far I go in the river, how I do my cast, whether I go out that day based on the water and how it's reacting around this rock? I mean, I don't know. It runs deep.
It does. And I think, you know, that is information that like humans have like sought for thousands of years that I think we're moving away from, right? Like that intimate acknowledgement of these subtle little things in a particular landscape. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And there's something for me, like when I'm in those places and I'm like truly focused and like present there, it's one of the only times in my life where I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm like, I'm 100% present. Do you know? And you find yourself in your tree stand, you're kind of drifting off, or you're thinking about like, oh, should I have to pay my health insurance bill? But you know those moments when you're so hyper aware, your senses kick up, your hearing gets a little bit better, right? And
It is the most meditative, and I think that's why I do factor in the animal to that moment, because in that moment, if I'm just in the space, my brain can drift. But if I'm in that moment and it's me and him or me and her or me and whatever, there is nothing else, and I feel myself become truly human. I mean, in its true form, I'm an animal in that moment.
Yes, exactly. And in some ways, like that animal is a manifestation of that particular place, right?
And then it's a matter. That's right. And then it's a matter of who's going to screw up first.
Yeah.
Is it me or is it you? whoever loses here, it's whoever made the mistake.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
So yeah. it's a very polarizing. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for giving me something to think about while I stand behind a tree today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So the book, did you feel a sense of control or getting control of your life in writing that and putting all those beautiful stories together? Or are you now just lost? Are you now more lost than ever?
I don't know if it's about a sense of control. I think for me, it was a process of, it sounds really corny to say, just like gaining more perspective and acceptance of who I am and like the way that I tick. And also, I think the cliche of like the strained relationship between the father and son, we've seen that in so many, you know, stories and works of art, et cetera, et cetera. And I've had issues with my dad, as everyone has, but my dad and I are extremely close. And part of this exploration is like, how do we stay present in those moments that mean so much to us when we know this person is not going to be around very long? Right. And that is the struggle that I have is like the recognition that, this is very temporary. And like, this sounds like I'm going to go off on some Buddhist tangent, which I'm not, but, I think hunting and being a good hunter requires your presence and your attention. And the struggle I have is not like this horrible friction with my father. It's like the opposite, you know, like having so much care for someone that it's overwhelming. And like, what do you do with that? Yeah.
Right. So you put it in words.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which is like, it's some representation of it. It's not everything. Yeah. And in a way, I think I did write for him. And also for like, for my future self, when my memory starts to fade, I have like those, you know, the images. I've been just talking to my students today about images, like the images, like the, when you're reading, right, the reading experience is you're viewing images. That's all reading is. It's just your mind viewing the story playing out in your head, right? But the image is like, it's my memory. It's like the physical detail of the moose. What part are you at the moose story? I don't want to tell you what happens. Where are you in the moose?
You guys have been tearing up and now you're back with your mate and the moose is in the middle of the road.
Oh, okay.
Oh, because I think, well, maybe because you, I got the PDF so late and I'm really sorry. I feel like I'm doing you a disservice, but I love you. Right. Okay. Tell me what happens. Tell me what happens.
Totally. I had never shot a deer before. I hunted deer pretty regularly since I was like 12. And you asked me about like sensitivity. I always thought there was something wrong with me because my dad would shoot a buck every year, even when his like hearing started to fade. You know, he can't hear me on the phone, but he can hear like a tree snap at 75 yards. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. So I started to internalize not harvesting a deer as like there was something wrong with me or that I was like putting off this energy in this tree stand that the deer were picking up on or something. And I got, you know, moose hunting in Maine, it's a lottery. And my grandfather applied for 22 years and never got it. And I got it and I did a lot of shooting. I did a lot of target shooting. And I just really wanted to be dialed in because I knew I wanted to kill the animal quickly. And I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want that to be even part of my thought process. I wanted it to be natural, right? And just when you start thinking, you're done already, right? So, I think what literally happened was we came across these two moose that were sparring. It was September. It was a misty morning. It was about 7 o'clock in the morning. Everything was kind of covered in dew. It's probably in like the low 50s. And like not much wind at all. And the moose that were sparring, these two bulls were probably 350 or 400 yards away on this ridgeline. And my dad's friend, Sean, used a cow. He does his own kind of mouth cow call. And the bull that was victorious in the fight was the one that responded to his call. So he won the fight, but he soon after paid the consequence for that. He started walking down this little logging road and I was on my tripod. My safety was off. My 308 was like ready to go. The plan was that my father was going to fire right after me if the moose didn't fall. And you know, moose can take a lot of lead and a lot of the guides would be like, they'll say like, keep shooting until it falls over. Right. because then you have the issue of retrieval and hauling them out when they weigh 1,000 pounds. Was walking dead on towards me. All of a sudden, it just sort of stepped off of the trail. Just no reason. It didn't seem like it winded us. It just disappeared. And it was this massive creature, and then it was gone. And we're all, the three of us, my dad, his friend Sean, and I were standing there like, what just happened? Like, what did we do? The wind seems okay. And we're sitting there talking and like feeling sorry for ourselves. And the thing just pops right back out on the road. And it's a little bit closer. And I have no memory of it, but I just like dropped to one knee, got on the tripod. I shot it right in the brisket, and it didn't do anything. It just stood there. My dad fired, and then soon after told me that his scope was foggy and he shouldn't have fired, and he's not sure if he hit it. And the moose like showed no sign of being hit. And I'm thinking, of course, like I've never had an experience of shooting a large animal at that time. So I thought like, how the fuck do you miss a moose? You know, at like 90 yards, I was feeling terrible about it. He kind of lumbered off in the woods. They're so big in your scope that you think that they're, it was actually much farther away than I thought when I shot. So we started looking for it at like 60, 70 yards. Didn't find, there's no blood, there's no hair. I was feeling nauseous, you know, like I wounded this thing or I missed, right? And I walked ahead. My dad and Sean stayed behind looking where they thought the moose was. I just kept walking down the road. And I heard it breathing. I heard like these raspy exhales.
That's it.
Yeah, and that was like its last few breaths. I hit it right through the heart. It went 15 feet and tipped over. It was dead by the time I got to it. It was this beautiful creature. The coat was like, you know, like just no markings at all. It had this silver tuft of hair on its hump, and just like completely slick with dew. It was a very overwhelming moment for sure. And also just there's a surreal moment of like standing over this creature that's 1,000 pounds that you've just killed, and sort of the recognition of that, of like, this is over. This moose's life is over. Like, what happens now? Right. That's the next page that you're going to read.
You work like hell is what happens now. Did you ever shoot another moose? Was that your last? I've never taken a moose. Admittedly, I'm just not around in one space long enough to eat a moose.
No, that's fair.
But no, did you take another one after that?
No, it's the lottery system. I have not gotten drawn again.
Right.
It's like, I think it's like between a 7% and 8% chance of being drawn, something like that. So it's not great.
What an experience.
Where
else does the book start to meander? What other stories do I have to look forward to, and do other people have to look forward to?
Oh man, I appreciate that. There's a lot of tarpon stuff. One of my favorite pieces though is a backcountry fishing trip with my guide and friend Rich, where it was like too cold for tarpon, even though I really wanted to go for them. And we, it was like a plan B type thing. We went in the backcountry, and it was like a little bit cold. The water was really low, and we found this spot out in the open where these giant snook were just kind of laying there, just kind of like just chilling. There was no one around. And we had like an hour and a half of just absolutely incredible fishing at these snook that were almost 40 inches and redfish as well. And that was the point where I had fished with them for 4 or 5 years at that point. And I said, let me pull for a second. And I'm much better at pulling now than I was then. He's like, you don't need to pull. Like, come on, the fishing, like stay up there, like get ready. There's another one up there. You know, like you're going to catch another one. And I had caught like two almost 40 inch snook, a couple of redfish in like 45 minutes. And I was like, this is incredible. And he finally let me pull. And he hadn't been on the pointy end for a really long time. Mm-hmm. So it was cool. That was sort of the moment in that relationship where it was like, he trusted me enough to get on the pulling platform of his, you know, his whip ray and and to get that shift in perspective of like watching your guide fish, who's now one of your good friends. I love that essay. And I mean, I think there's a lot of the sort of evolution of those relationships. And my friend Parker, who I love, there's a piece about going up to extreme northern Maine, trying to get him his first muskie, which he catches at like 5:30 at night. after paddling 5 miles up current in this like small tributary that used to be a trout stream that now has muskie. I hope what people connect with most is the evolution of their relationships. I mean, this is not a how-to book. This is not a book that is me like telling you how amazing I am because I caught a tarpon. It's really about the relationships that I've developed doing those things.
Yeah, I gathered that. I didn't pick up ego at all in the book.
Oh, good. That's good. Yeah. And so my hope is that people will have that dual experience that we kind of talked about earlier, whereas you're reading the book about the moose hunt, but you're also simultaneously having an experience of tapping into something that's happened in your life. So you have this sort of like dynamic experience of experiencing something that I really, really want to share with you, but also tapping back into something that's very meaningful for you.
Was there anything that you put in the book or any chapters that you wrote that you later took out?
Oh yeah. 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 I honestly, like this was my process. I had a bunch of published material from, I'm a senior contributor at the Drake. So I have a bunch of stuff that Tom published for me. I have some stuff from Gray's Meat Eater that I kind of like revised a little bit. I put all of it in a Word document and it was like, I forget how many pages, a lot of pages. It wasn't a book. It was just like a dump of all of my, you know, like published work into one space, just this big, massive file. So I had to go through and think about, there were a couple of pieces that I really like, some of my best writing, I think, that like did not fit with the narrative that was like showing itself, that was kind of appearing, which was these three relationships, the return to these places, return to Northern Maine, return to my home waters in Central Maine, return to the Keys, and drawing some kind of like interesting but weird parallels between Maine and Florida, like opposite ends of the of Route One, you know. And it was a process of I was talking to my students about this today. When you have the ability to kind of zoom out of your work, sometimes you'll see the things that don't belong, and it can be difficult. I wrote a piece about the worm hatch in the Keys, and the way the tarpon respond to that. And I love that piece. That's like one of the pieces that I'm most proud of. But it has absolutely nothing to do with these characters in the book, like these people that I love. So I had to do the hard work of removing and like carving, right? And it's sort of like, I think of like a sculpture, you have to kind of keep cutting and carving and eventually you'll start to see something, right? And the more you get rid of that doesn't need to be there, the more it kind of becomes itself in a way. And that was my experience with, it was mostly cutting and then reorganizing and thinking about, okay, there has to be some kind of linear progression of all three of these relationships. They all have to, those three relationships, my dad, Parker, and Rich, they all have to evolve in the course of the book. And I need to evolve during the course of the book, right? Characters evolve, they change, they want something, they interact with people. Those relationships are not in a vacuum. Those relationships change. They're strained, they're great, they're strained again, that kind of thing. So I was mindful of like being okay with getting rid of stuff that I love that didn't serve the book. And also like digging back into these characters and thinking about, okay, how can I show you, someone who's thousands of miles away, who picks up this book, what it's like to walk a logging road with my dad when he's 70 and he's put off his knee surgery till after hunting season and he can barely kind of keep up, you know? You have to kind of think about these people you know and love and think about in as few brushstrokes as possible, like how can I paint this picture for this other person, right? So that was the work of the book, getting rid of what didn't belong, building up the characters, and like thinking about the linear progression of the relationships in a way that kind of mirrors the way that relationships evolve over time. Yeah. And my relationship to these places that I returned to in different states of mind and different, you know, there's one essay where for a summer I was living in a camper behind my dad's house. So there's me at very different phases of my life as well. Some of these essays, there are some like flashbacks to when I was a boy, but I mean, it covers quite a swath of time in my life. So, yeah.
How did you feel when you put the last full stop in it and the book was done to the best of your ability? And you've said to yourself for the first time, it's done. How did you feel?
Yeah, I remember that quite well. I mean, I think there's a level of terror, because what happens is like you have this thing that you're really close to, and you there's like these people in here that you really love, and then you realize that it's no longer yours. Like it goes out in the world, and then it's like someone else's to experience. And I felt like this pretty psyched about the accomplishment of like, okay, I've been in this and working on this for 7 years. I need some space from it. We need to like see other people for a while, kind of thing. And also, I also thought of like, yeah, but fuck, but a bunch of people are going to read this now, right? And it's like, is Rich going to be pissed at the way I describe him when he's grumpy because my buddy made a bad cast when he was guiding me? Or like, is my dad going to think that I wrote him as like a curmudgeon when he's really a really sensitive, sweet guy, right? Or that part, I make fun of Parker because he's really short. Is he going to be upset about that? Like, these are the things that like the sensitive mind thinks of, and you're like, fuck, I wish I could just not be sensitive. How do I just like not care? How do I care less, you know, which I've never been good at. But it's also like, there is like a level of privilege of just being able to like finish a piece of work and then share it with people, which is kind of an honor. And the thing I talk to my students about is like, my goal with any piece of writing is that the person who picks it up will finish it. Like, what can I do as a writer? What tools do I have so that you will not put the book down? Right? Because we have a million distractions. We have a million things we could do. Our phone is dinging every 40 seconds. I want to the best of my ability, make it very difficult for you to put the story down. I want you to finish the story. Did I pull that off? I don't know. But it's my first book too, right? So it's sort of like, maybe I'll look back at this in 10 years and grimace. Like, you look at yourself in eighth grade with like a bowl cut and you're like, oh my God, that was me. What was I thinking? Maybe I'll look at these stories that way, right?
I think it's inevitable. I think every writer looks back and would change things. But I hope that you see it as, I mean, if you didn't write them now, the memories would just get more blurry as the time goes on. So they had to be put down.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, now is the time, right?
Yeah. Well, I love it. And the only reason I put it down was because of our Zoom issue yesterday. So I need a paper copy. Where can we get copies of the book from?
Sure. So it was published by Islandport, one word, Islandport Press, which is a small press in Maine. So you can look at Islandport Press's website. There's also an independent bookstore in Maine. If you want to support independent bookstores, it's called Back Cove Books. And you can look them up online and search for the book. It's called Tributaries. And it was their best-selling memoir of 2023, which is pretty cool. And they really kind of championed the book on a local level. So I'm like very appreciative to them.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go on Amazon if you have no soul, but I would rather.
I was sitting here thinking, will he, will he not? Will he, will he not?
I will.
I know you didn't want to, but do you sell it direct? Do you have a website going right now?
Yeah, I have a website, which is my name, ryanbro.com. It will link you to the bookstore and the publisher to buy it. I don't have copies that I sell directly. I wish I did, but I don't.
Yeah. Yep. And that's Ryan with a Y and Brod, B-R-O-D.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just for people who are wondering. So they don't have to go all the way back to the episode and read the title. So open your phone and buy it. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to finally get to meet you and sit down. Is there, I know there's lots to talk about, but for the purpose of today's episode, is there anything that you would like to add?
No, I can't think of anything else. It's an honor to talk to you. And, I've been listening to your podcast for a long time. One of my favorite writers is Aaron Block. I assigned one of Aaron's essays to my students this semester. She has, if anyone is interested in a short but beautiful essay, she has this essay called Solo, which is about her hunting snowshoe hare in Colorado by herself. It's an absolutely beautiful essay. Like, I get weepy every time I read it. I got to assign it to my students, and then she joined. I mean, I'm in Maine, she's in Colorado, but she joined us via Zoom. And I had all of my 12 students come up with a question to ask her. And we had this lovely conversation. So I really loved your episode with her. It's just great to talk to you. And I really appreciate the opportunity to chat to like a fellow angler obsessive and to talk about the book a little bit.
Yeah. Well, likewise. And I look forward to hearing how your 40s go. I'm very curious to see which full-time role you end up taking, because you will be taking one on in the next few years.
I'm going to have to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, don't hang up. I will stop recording. Thank you. Let me stop. And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening.
miss Mondays with Into the Blue, brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Every Monday night from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment. Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.